Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health Podcast, sponsored by Vifor Pharma. This is your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm delighted to be exploring the fascinating and evolving therapeutics in nephrology. To assist me is Professor Lorraine Harper from the University of Birmingham in the UK, who has special expertise in vasculitis, and that's going to be the focus of our conversation. Lorraine is fluent in the field of inflammation and nephrology and has published over 70 research papers in scientific journals, having received major grants from the Medical Research Council as well as Medical Research UK. At the University of Birmingham, she's extensively involved in the delivery of the medical school's undergraduate curriculum and has long been a vocal supporter of academic training for junior clinical researchers there. Together, we'll consider the key goals in the clinical management of antineutrophilic cytoplasmic autoantibody, or ANCA-associated vasculitis, as well as the challenges that present themselves when real-world practices come into play. Welcome to the podcast, Lorraine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you for a very nice introduction.
Well, it's having surveyed your very impressive resume, I could have gone on for a lot longer. But let's leap into this. What are the current challenges when it comes to achieving remission in patients with ANCA-associated vasculitis using the current treatment paradigms?
So I think that we are, with the therapies we currently have, we are quite good at getting patients into remission, but it really does depend on how we define that remission. Achieving settling the inflammation that occurs with ANCA vasculitis in most patients occurs quite quickly with steroids and cyclophosphamide, or steroids and rituximab, which are our current therapies. And as time goes through, as the inflammation settles, we reduce the steroids. We then change to maintenance therapy around about 6 months when patients are in remission. But some patients don't manage to reduce the steroids rapidly and aren't able to maintain their disease in a remission state at lower levels of steroids. And then in amongst that, you've got the problems of toxicity associated with the current therapies that we have. So steroids are notorious for, especially when being given at high doses, being associated with mood disturbance, sleep disturbance, infection, weight gain, hypertension, the list goes on. And I think that one of the things that we are most concerned about as physicians is that risk of infection during that acute stage. And certainly with the change from reducing the doses of cyclophosphamide we use and switching to rituximab, which has got less associated toxicity, steroids have continued to be used. We've never been able to reduce the risk of infection despite the changes we've made round about cyclophosphamide and rituximab. So I think one of the biggest current challenges about getting patients into remission is perhaps not achieving a quiescent disease state, but achieving a quiescent disease state in a very safe manner and maintaining patients in that state of remission.
So that's remission. What about relapse? It's always a legitimate concern. What are the risk factors and the, as well as the acute and long-term consequences for relapse? Plus, to what extent is this a concern and how often does it occur?
So relapse is essentially, as you know, just a recurrence of disease activity. And the relapse can occur at any time in a patient's journey, provided they have achieved disease remission. And it also, the frequency of relapse depends on whether you're looking at relapse in a state where you're giving patients maintenance immunosuppression or whether you've stopped immunosuppression. So Currently, all patients who've gone into remission will then be transferred to a maintenance immunosuppressant regime, which is less toxic than that initially used, often low-dose steroids and an alternative immunosuppressant, either from cyclophosphamide, or if they've had frequent relapses before, they may be maintained on maintenance rituximab therapy. And relapses on immunosuppression probably occur at a rate of about 10% per annum. And that rate is probably persistent throughout. Patients who are off immunosuppression may relapse their disease somewhere between the rates of 10 and 30% per annum. And it's a bit difficult to know the exact rate and the exact problem associated with relapse is that we're not that good at studying relapse. It's very idiosyncratic to the individual. We don't have any very good biomarkers that reliably predict relapse, and so all patients tend to get treated the same. But patients who remain ANCA positive during remission are at higher risk of relapse. Patients who go from being ANCA negative to being ANCA positive have an increased risk of relapse. And a rising titer of ANCA antibody also probably increases your risk of relapse. But none of those things are secure enough just to base therapy on your ANCA changes. Other clinical factors that increase your risk of relapse are things such as your disease type. So if you have granulomatosis with polyangiitis, which generally associates with PR3 ANCA, you're more likely to relapse than those patients who've got MPO ANCA, vasculitis, or microscopic polyangiitis. Patients who've got worse renal involvement are less likely to relapse than patients who've got upper respiratory tract disease. We know that there is a biomolecular signature that is expressed by T cells that suggest that you may have an increased risk of relapse, but certainly that's not a signature that can be used in the clinical setting, or at least at the moment. And that relapse signature is not totally specific to ANCA vasculitis. It often replicates in other relapsing chronic autoimmune diseases. But as I say, it's not something that we can use in the clinic at the moment. And that leaves us as a problem because we don't have good markers that identify within the individual who will relapse and who won't relapse. But it's safe to say that a patient who relapses once is more likely to relapse a second time. And the longer you go without a relapse, the less likely you are to relapse. But as I said at the beginning of this conversation, relapse risk occurs about 10% per annum over the course of a patient's career. So just because you haven't relapsed in the first 10 years doesn't mean to say you will never relapse. And I have seen patients who relapse upwards of 20 years from presenting their initial disease. Now, relapse severity is very dependent on whether or not you are on how you originally presented and how aware you are of your original presentation. And I think we recognise that many relapses are milder than the original disease presentation because both patients and physicians are much more attuned to the symptoms of relapse. But patients do have severe relapses. Again, it is completely idiosyncratic within the individual as to how they relapse and the consequences of that relapse. Relapse itself does not seem to be a risk factor for mortality, but there are certainly some data around that suggests that if you have relapse and kidney disease, then that is a risk factor for end-stage renal disease.
Right. Well, I'm sure it's reassuring. That last comment is reassuring for patients, not the end-stage renal disease, but the fact that it's not predictive of relapse, isn't predictive of mortality, if I understood you correctly. But from your experience with patients, how do they tend to view relapse, and what can we do to improve clinical care in the future for these patients?
So I think relapse is something that most patients are worried about, and that concern changes as they go through their disease history. So getting control of the disease is really paramount, of paramount importance during that first year, when patients are getting used to dealing with the disease, dealing with the new therapies that they have to take, and really understanding what the disease is as a consequence on their lives. As they then progress through, I think they learn to live with the disease, and then they start to worry more about the risks of the drugs that they are taking. When the disease hasn't been around for a while, they're perhaps less conscious of the disease itself and more conscious of the toxicities associated with therapy. But there is certainly, when you start to consider discontinuing immunosuppression, there is a significant level of anxiety about the disease coming back and what that means for them, particularly if they've had a significant illness in the first instance, because some of these patients have had extremely frightening disease that has taken them to ITU, or some of them may have required dialysis during the stages of presentation, and they're worried that this will come back. We need better indicators of relapse and predictors of relapse. We need better awareness of what relapse looks like in an early stage. And we certainly need better therapies that are associated with less toxicity in order to manage long-term immunosuppression within patients as an individual. And also, in some way, we need to start to think about personalising the management of these patients to improve longer-term outcomes. We've certainly come a long way in the last 40 years since we started to use cyclophosphamide and prednisolone as therapy for these patients. Untreated, 80% of patients before the introduction of therapy would have died within 2 years. We're so much better now, but we still need to do much better. And I think that where we need to focus our attention and research moving forward has to be round about disease relapse and better management of that relapse.
Well, it strikes me, given those observations, that we're going to have you back on to give us an update. This is a fascinating area, Lorraine, not one I was terribly knowledgeable about before, but I certainly will go to bed less dumb tonight. So I want to thank you again, Professor Harper, for taking the time to join us on this podcast and for sharing your expertise. Given that we're all patients sooner or later, I also want to thank you for all your work in research, as well as all the good you do in training the next generation of doctors and other healthcare professionals.
Thank you.
Very welcome. That's all we have time for today on this episode, folks. So please join me, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, soon to hear from more great guests and to receive the latest updates across all fields of healthcare. Take care. Bye for now.